All right, we're going to go ahead and start our class this morning. Welcome, everybody. So I mentioned that last Wednesday night when we finished up Philippians, I mentioned that Stephen and I were going to do a little tag team class on Wednesday night about, you know, how do you use resources, information resources in your Bible study? And a lot of that's going to be things like talking about, you know, when... Are there some sites that we could say, if you really want to go to a site that's relatively sound, here's a good one to go to, because there's lots of ones that aren't, right? There's, you know, when you read about, when you say, I want to go read about the Apostle Peter, and you go to Wikipedia or you go to Google and you type in Apostle Peter, you're going to get the first thing you hit, and you're going to click at it and look at it. How do you use those things effectively and not get misled? So today, I just thought I would start with an earlier, a little more general lesson, since I was doing a kind of one-off for Stephen here, which is talking about the challenge that we have in our modern day and how we deal with it. The problem's always been around, but technology, and especially our modern day technology, puts us in a really different situation. And I think I think younger generations that grow up with it, they're going to be adapted to it, but especially those of us who are older generation, it's hard for us. You know, because we grew up, at least, you know, there's a good number of us in here who grew up listening to Walter Cronkite every night saying, and that's the way it is. It isn't, well, maybe check the other channels to see if they agree. You know, it was, and that's the way it is. And you trusted them. You didn't even question it. You trusted them. You know, and it was that way too with our leaders, with our presidents and government. And even though we've had government scandals all the way back as long as there's been government, right? And there are politicians who lie all the way back as far as you want to go. But in general, if the president got up and said something, you said, okay, that's the way it is. You know, well, that's not the case anymore, right? It's like, okay, well, who agrees with him? Who doesn't agree with him? What, you know, and this is the situation we're in. And I want to talk about, in general, about understanding information technology and what's happened and what situation that puts us in and why we have to be aware of it. And then I'm going to talk about some high-level ideas about how do you sift through this information. We're going to talk more about Bible sources and Bible study sources in the next few lessons. So I have TMI up here. TMI stands for too much information. Sometimes that's a joke, like someone's telling you something you just really wish you didn't know all that detail. Right? But that's the world we live in today. Too much information. And I have another one over here, which is a fish. Art, can you tell me the species of fish? What kind of fish is this?
Depending on whether it's saltwater or freshwater.
Right. Well, it's not any particular species, but I thought I'd just ask you. But the key here is this is a fish prepared to be eaten. And there is meat on it, and there are bones on it. What's the problem with eating fish bones?
It can choke you.
It can choke you, and what else?
Stick to the back of your throat.
It can poke your innards, and you can die of sepsis. I mean, it's dangerous to get sharp fish bones down inside your gut. And then there's a book, and then what's this? It's a salt shaker. And so what do you, and you know, because it has lots of holes on the top. Pepper shakers always have fewer holes on the top than salt shakers. That's the lesson I kind of try to remember myself. Why do you think there's a salt shaker up here?
You salt your fish.
I do. You ever heard of, you better take that with a grain of salt? Okay. I actually found once when I did a presentation for IBM, I actually found the picture of the largest salt crystal that's ever been found. And there was a guy in a mine, this giant salt mine, and there was a cube crystal of salt, because that's the shape of salt crystals or cubes, and it was this tall and this wide. It was huge. And I used that. I said, okay, what I'm about to tell you, here's your grain of salt. In other words, I'm not trusting it too far. Now, I was trying to think of how to do this, because normally we do, you know, Bible study. We're talking about the Bible. We're talking about what God says. Here I got to talk about just information in general and all the information we get. One of the problems, And I kind of titled this lesson, Who Do You Trust and Who Do You Listen To? Some of y'all old enough might remember John Denver. He's had a lot of really pretty songs, pretty love songs and various things. And he had a song that started this way. I guess growing isn't hard to do, just stand against the wall. Once I was just 2 feet high, today I'm 6 feet tall. But knowing who to listen to is something else again. Words just whistle around my head like seasons in the wind. And that's really the situation we find ourselves in today. And even more so, accelerated by the internet. I mean, he did this song back in the 60s and 70s, right? It's when the song came out. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the history of information technology. I don't want everybody to glaze over and, you know. But there's a reason for this because of how it impacts us and how it affects us. And I want you to understand. So in the very beginning, if you had some information and you wanted to give it to somebody else, what did you do? You talk to them, right? They didn't have written languages. They didn't have books. They didn't have any of that, right? You talked. And in fact, the storyteller was a big part of a community. In fact, it was a normal part of life. You'd sit and tell stories to your children, and the local elder would, tribal elder or whatever, would sit down and tell you stories about different things, sit around the campfire and tell stories. And storytelling has been around a very long time, basically as long as man's been around. You could imagine that Adam and Eve sat around the campfire one night with Cain and Abel, who were just boys at the time, and saying, let me tell you what it was like in the Garden of Eden. Right? You just imagine that that's probably what they did. We do that. Now, the effectiveness of that kind of communication had to do with the skill of the storyteller and the attentiveness of the listener. Right? The next kind of level you had was theater and acting, where people would have a play where they'd tell a story and they'd act it out. And you see this in Native American culture, for instance, really common. The dances that Native American cultures do in the United States are actually acting out stories. Sometimes there's stories about hunting, or there's stories about spirits or something like that. And the effectiveness of that kind of communication was, typically you could have a larger group of people listening, and based on the skill of the playwright and this, who wrote the thing, and the skills of the actors had something to do with how effective it was. Right? And you think about Shakespeare. Right, Shakespeare is an amazing playwright, wrote all kinds of amazing plays. But have you ever seen a really awful production of Hamlet? I have. I've seen some really good ones, but I've seen some really terrible ones, and it depended on the skill of the person who was acting it out. Okay, then came writing in books. Before Shakespeare. Written language and scrolls and books were revolutionary, and this is before the printing press. They were revolutionary because you could write down a detailed account of something. It might be some historical thing that you saw happen. It might be something from the Bible, right? You could do that. And then you could make copies of it, and you could send it to people who were far away from the original person, the source, the storyteller. So it was the first kind of broadcast. It wasn't very broad. But you could put a book on a ship and send it around the other side of the world, and someone over there could get the message without the storyteller themselves having to go there. It was a big deal. It allowed us to have very large stories. By stories here, I don't mean they're necessarily true or false. It's just somebody telling something. And it allowed for things like the Bible. It allowed for large historical reference works like Josephus, for instance, or Julius Caesar. It allowed for things like dictionaries and encyclopedias and concordances, where people would study something and they'd share their study results with everybody by writing books. And this went on for, a couple thousand years. Then you got the printing press. Now, the problem with books before then was you had to handwrite them, which meant it was difficult to copy, slow, expensive, and fraught with error, because the guy, if you weren't paying attention, especially if you were copying something you didn't know the language, and an awful lot of the monks in monasteries in the Dark Ages were copying Greek and Latin texts of the Bible, didn't read Greek or Latin. They were literally copying the symbol. So they couldn't error check themselves. If they made a mistake, they didn't realize it, right, until someone else read it. So there was a lot of issues with written works. The printing press, though, changed that. Gutenberg made his printing press, and it allowed for relatively fast. In other words, you could make 1,000 copies in a month, instead of 1,000 copies taking 10 years of handwriting, right? You could do it relatively cheaply. So if somebody had some money, they could print some books. And then, of course, it allowed for mass production of written works. And, you know, Bible was one of the very first ones of those, but there were others. Then we came to newspapers. Now, newspapers, some of us are old enough. It really wasn't happening by my time around, where the newspaper headline was kind of the source of truth, right? And the newspapers were printed every day. All of a sudden, it wasn't like you print a book and there's a book and you can read the book for 20 years. It's like you get new news every day. You get new stories every day. Because the printing got cheaper and faster, and the distribution network of people selling papers could get broader. And that's how the American Revolution started, right? Because Thomas Paine and a few people like that started writing some stuff and broadcasting it and handed it out in the streets, and people got all upset and, you know, started a revolution. Then you went to radio. Radio was a real difference from newspapers, because for one, it was instantaneous. If somebody got on the radio and said something, millions of people could hear it all at the same time. Okay? That's really, really different than a book, right? Because you'd say, well, you got to get the book, you got to print the book, you got to distribute the book, and people have to buy the book, and then they have to take the time to read it. With a radio, you could get a message out instantaneously. And because it could, you could record music and speeches, usually by inspirational speakers, politicians and preachers and various other things. It really hooked people's emotions. And that's a really important change in information. Before, if you read a book and the writer was skillful and you were interested in the book, it might catch up your emotions in it, right? And you read a novel or read the Bible or something like that. But here, they actually were playing with your emotions. They intentionally would play certain things to try to get you to feel certain ways. One of the great examples of the impact of radio over, say, TV was H.G. Wells wrote a book called The War of the Worlds. It was acted out on radio. When it was acted out on radio for the first time, people went nuts. They believed it was a news broadcast because it starts out acting like a news broadcast. And so it was faking a news broadcast. They were just telling a story. They're not trying to lie to anybody. They even started out, they introduced it. We're going to tell a story. It's by H.G. Wells, and here's what it's talking about. But nobody heard that part. What they heard was, flash, you know, aliens have landed in New Jersey. You know, they're terrible. They're destroying everything. People got so upset with that there's cases where people went out and put shotgun blasts into their neighboring water towers because they thought they were the aliens in their spaceships. That never happened with a book, ever. Okay? So all of a sudden there was this immediacy of the information and the emotional, and then not being able to tell if it was true or not, started happening really fast, so fast there was no time to talk to everybody. There was no time to have a town meeting and say, did y'all hear this? Because all it would have taken is one person saying, oh yeah, that's that book by H.G. Wells. It's fiction, don't worry about it. And everyone would go, oh, okay. But they didn't have time for that. They felt like the aliens had landed. They were going out. You remember 9/11? Same thing happened with TV as well. TV takes on this same thing. When 9/11 happened, for a couple of weeks after that, everybody thought that there was going to be a terrorist attack in their town. Everybody thought that. Right? So radio started bringing in emotions and instantaneous, and this notion of I can't really tell if it's true or not. And it gave people a really powerful megaphone. You know, before radio, even with newspapers, it wasn't as powerful. If somebody really wanted to get a whole bunch of people following them, they had to be a great speaker, and they had to get a big, big group of people together, and they'd talk to them and whip them up and get them going in a direction. You know, that might have been Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address, or it might have been Adolf Hitler, right? But it took a person who was really charismatic to get up and do this. Now, when movies came along, movies added yet another dimension. They added the visual dimension. So it had all the sound stuff, the emotional sound stuff, right? But now it had the visual dimension. You ever notice, I know it was because they couldn't project it very brightly, but you ever notice where you go watch movies? In a sensory deprivation room called a movie theater. Because it's dark, right? It's dark and it's quiet and you can't hear any noise from outside. Why? So you can focus your entire being on that thing that's coming at you on the screen. And it was very compelling. Whether it was a newsreel or whether it was a fiction, some sort of fantasy, it was very compelling and it dominated your senses and really influenced you. You know, one of the most influential movies I ever watched? There were a couple. First one was on TV, was The Ten Commandments, Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. One of the next ones, when I was a little older, was the very first Star Wars movie. I was 18 years old, went to movie theater, and all of a sudden here was this amazing vision of the future of robots and space travel and all this kind of stuff, and I was really hooked. Yeah, but it was because of the nature of the medium and how it was produced. Now, television, when it came along, kind of combined a bunch of those things. It combined news from newspapers. You could hear about it daily. Now you could hear about it three times a day. You know, and of course, now we have 24-hour news channels. You can never shut off the news. It's always there. It had all the music and sound of radio, and it had all the visual qualities of movies, and it was in everybody's home. So you didn't even have to get up and go to a movie theater, right? It was there. I grew up with television in the house. I watched unbelievable numbers of hours. Originally, we had a few broadcast channels. It was all broadcast, so whatever went out on the waves, everybody got. There were only two or three. They were heavily regulated by the government. And there were some local channels, too, but they were usually associated, affiliated with ABC, CBS, or NBC, right? And they were very controlled. In the 80s and 90s, we had cable television. What did cable television do? How did it change? First of all, instead of having three or four or five channels, you had 200 or 300, or 100, you know, a bunch. Also, those channels, because you paid for them directly and they were not broadcast, could show anything they wanted without government regulation. Now, there were some attempts to regulate cable television. But if you have satellite television or cable television today, you know full well that there are some channels on there that are broadcast all the time that have stuff that would never, ever have been broadcast on television in the 1970s. Right? So all of a sudden, there was a way for people to broadcast things without any real control on the content or the context. They could say anything they wanted, and that had a big effect. And all of a sudden, too, it was international, right? The same channel would be visible around the world. So then came the internet. So now what the internet's done is basically given everybody their own channels. You can create your own channel of information, and millions of people across the world can watch it for free, basically. And this creates a whole other situation, because it used to be there were a few numbers of people who could produce, you know, movies or broadcast television shows. Only the wealthy and powerful could do that. Now, all of a sudden, everybody can. Everybody. Literally everybody. There are 31 million YouTube channels today. I checked last night. Those are channels. That's just not somebody doing I'm going to stick something out on YouTube. That's something that they put regular stuff on that people subscribe to. Some of these channels have millions of subscribers. Some of them have millions of subscribers that pay them for it. I spend a lot of time on YouTube. I don't watch TV anymore. One of the reasons I do is I can find the things I'm interested in on YouTube, right? Because there's 31 million channels. The 10 that I really care about, you know, are out there along with a bunch of stuff I don't care about. There are 1.79 billion people use Facebook every day. That's like a sixth of the population of the planet. There are 120 million fake Facebook accounts. And something on the order of 100,000 or so new fake ones every day, and Facebook has a whole department who shut down 100,000 fake ones a day. So what does that start telling you? Not only does everybody have the ability to talk to everybody, there's a lot of people willing to lie in what they're doing, to use this thing in a way like that. So there is worse than going from broadcast TV to cable TV. On the internet, there's absolutely no regulation that actually works universally. Okay? So there's no way for someone to say, nobody's going to see this. Now, actually, there's a couple of cases. Germany, for instance, something like 60% of the internet content is not viewable in Germany. They actually set up a wall a digital wall, and they won't let any of that come through. But almost everybody else is wide open. Government will try to stop certain things, you know, like child pornography, for instance. But if you're clever in how you bounce your signals around, you can get around all that. For anything. If you want to watch sports, you can do that. So all of this is telling us something. First of all, there's no one else out there regulating the content that we're being fed. Anybody can do it. There's no trust source like we used to have in our governments or the newscaster we trusted like Walter Cronkite or something. This has created a million echo chambers. And an echo chamber is an idea of like everybody who just wants to hear what they want to hear all go in the echo chamber and all they can hear is each other talking. They can't hear anything else. Right? And what this allows is a fragmentation. Used to be, we know this in our own country, right? Used to be, you would say, I'm an American. You know, and that meant something. It doesn't mean near as much as it used to. But now, it's like, of which tiny slice of, you know, subgroup do I adhere to? And usually that's wrapped up with some commentator I'm listening to on the internet or some, you know, something I'm doing is kind of my little team, my little tribe over here. It's fragmented our culture and caused all kinds of cultural problems. You can see it just in the last, you know, couple of years here, but a lot more than that. So when everyone has a megaphone, which is what we have, what do you get? Lots of noise. You don't get lots of information, you get lots of noise. Now, who should you listen to? Who should you trust? It's a puzzling question when you think about it, because we grew up trusting authority in our government or in our community or an author of a book. You know, if somebody wrote a book, remember how important it was to write a book 30 or 40 years ago? If someone wrote a book, it was saying something. You know, they had to be vetted somehow. They were worth at least listening to. Somebody had said, this is an important person because we're going to spend a lot of money, because you just cost a lot of money, to publish a book. You know what now? I could take my notes from this class and I could publish it and have it up on Amazon as a hardback edition in about an hour. And I think for the grand total cost of maybe 10 bucks a copy. Anybody can do it. So our trust sources have kind of evaporated, at least the earthly trust sources. So Christians, of course, I'm going to talk about context and especially the context of the speakers here in a minute. But Christians, of course, we have a worldview. Everybody has a worldview. A worldview is kind of your fundamental set of beliefs. You know, there are people who believe that gravity doesn't exist, fundamentally. You know, but not most of us don't. Most of us believe it. But Christians believe two things fundamentally. God exists and God breathed. Inspiration. The Bible is His word. And we base a lot of our understanding of things in the world on those two facts that we believe. Now, when you're getting information from somewhere, and we all do, right? You can either go hunt for it, you can get on Wikipedia and ask a question or Google something, you can go buy books, you can do whatever you want, listen to radio, YouTube channels, whatever. How do we know who to trust? So one of the first things you have to do is look at the speaker. This is all about context. Right, if Gilbert was here, he would have already said that. And I learned a lot from Gilbert. And the importance of context is one of those lessons. So one thing you ask is who the speaker is. What's their baggage? What's their background? For instance, my late wife was very sick and was suffering from depression. And her medical doctor suggested that she go see a psychiatrist to maybe try to help with the depression. And we were in Irving, Texas, and we went to see a psychiatrist. I'd never been to one before. And the psychiatrist talked to her for a little bit, and the result was you need to give up your religion, put your very sick 12-month-old daughter in the daycare and get a job, get a profession. First time we'd ever gone to one. We didn't have any basis of comparison. Turns out the guy was a Hindu, too. He had no belief in God, or no belief in the Christian's God. And so, you know, normally you'd say, I'm going to go to a psychiatrist. He's been to school. He's got a medical degree. You know, he's trustworthy. But he wasn't. And that happens a lot. So you have to ask yourself the question, who is this person that's talking to me? What do I know about him? Can you identify him? First of all, there's a lot of anonymous, you know, there's a lot of, we talk about fake news and things, like you can go on the internet and see a lot of it. You'll see some video that looks like a professionally produced news broadcast like you used to watch, you know, on mainstream TV. But you don't know who that person is talking. You have no clue. They don't say, here's so-and-so, you know, you should trust them. Who's the speaker? What organization are they with? What are their affiliations? What's their worldview? Sometimes that's educational worldview, you know. Do they have a degree? Where's the degree from? Sometimes it has to do with their cultural worldview. What culture do they grow up in? Like, for instance, if you grew up in China, you would not be able, fundamentally, on a lot of dimensions, you would not be able to understand. If you've grown up in China, lived in China your whole life, you could not understand what it is to be an American, to live here. Same thing with us in China. Because we just haven't experienced it, right? It's so deeply ingrained in us, our expectations and assumptions. So when somebody from a different culture makes a statement, you have to say, hold it, they're coming from that culture. We got to keep that all in mind. We got to, you know, pull out that salt shaker and shake it a little bit. Understand that. What about experts? Now, I always loved it. Gilbert used to say this, you know, say, whenever you see something that says scholars say, what does that mean? That somebody who has some sort of academic degree said it. That's all it means. Should you trust them because they got a master's or a PhD? How many times does a so-called expert render an opinion? And let's just say they have a degree, but it's not in the thing they're rendering their opinion about. You ever seen that? Happens all the time. You know, someone says, I'm a PhD in biochemistry, and I'm giving you opinions about monetary policy or something like that. You know, why? I mean, you might be smart. You know, maybe that says, okay, you were smart enough to get that degree. Maybe you got some smarts, but you're not an expert in that field. What about experts? You know, a lot of times when you look at, say, Wikipedia, and I do this when I'm teaching my Bible classes, one of the first things I do when we're studying a letter like Philippians or Ephesians is I'll go read the Wikipedia article on the book of Ephesians or Philippians. And Wikipedia is like a giant encyclopedia on the internet, but Wikipedia can be written and edited by anyone on the internet, and is. That's how all the information gets there. Most people don't know this. It's actually a pretty trustworthy source from a standpoint of at least you can find out what people think, because anybody can write anything there. And they have arguments. They have disagreements. You know, let's say so-and-so says this, so-and-so says this on the same page. But if you go, say, for instance, read the Wikipedia entry on the book of Isaiah, it will say modern scholars believe that there were three different people who wrote the book of Isaiah. It was not written by one person. Okay, somebody wrote that. Someone who held that opinion wrote that. But what can you tell just about that? First of all, they say scholars. Who? We don't know. What's their credentials? Why should I believe them? Why should I trust them? One of the first things they'll say, and there's a lot of situations like this when you read things like relatively secular data sources on biblical topics, is they're written by people who don't even believe in God. And they say, well, the Bible says this and this and this about this and this and this. And you say, hold it, you don't even believe in God. You know, what qualifies you to tell me what God says? You know, and this is the kind of thing that happens a lot. One of the things you'll hear a lot of times is modern scholars say. What does that mean? If something is modern, I guess we're back into it again, because used to be it was modern. It was mod back in the 60s, right? Then it was modern. Then it was postmodern. Now we're back to modern again. So I guess modern's cool. What does it mean when you say modern scholars say something? What does it mean? Got any ideas?
They since they didn't agree with the previous squad.
Right. That's the one thing you know. The older generation, they're disagreeing with. But there's also a claim to truth based on saying, well, this is modern, and therefore truer, more trustworthy than old. Okay. Let's talk about common sense a little bit, because one of the things people say a lot is, well, just use your common sense. That's actually a pretty good guide most of the time. But what is common sense? Have you ever thought about it? I think about it a lot because in my research, when I'm trying to figure out, you know, is it possible to create a machine that acts and thinks sort of like a person, you got to think about common sense. You know, if you were able to do that, the jury's way out, but if you were able to do that, you'd have to say, so what is common sense? What is it? What do you think common sense is?
Well, my opinion is common sense is being able to make a decision using logical information and then producing a, that's your common sense.
So you're talking about common sense as a reasoning process. That normal people in common, it's common that most people, when presented with this information, would draw this conclusion,
right.
Something like that. Another aspect of common sense has to do literally with common sense, common sensation. Like, for instance, it is common sense that gravity exists. Why? Because we're all stuck to our seats right now. We're not floating in the room. You know, if Katie was floating in the room there, she might argue. She'd say, what do you mean gravity? I'm floating up here in the air. But it's because of common sensation. But there's a limit to common sense. And one of the limits is, one, you might not be a clear, as we used to say, clear thinking person, right? Like, when have you ever said that person doesn't have any common sense? We've sure said it, haven't we? Now, they probably believe in gravity, right? But what we're saying is, they're not too good at drawing what everybody else would say was a good conclusion, right? They make some really bad decisions based on some faulty reasoning. But common sense has limits based on your own experience. So, for instance, there is common sense that you acquire by having been married. You learn about that kind of relationship intimately. It's hard, good times and bad times and everything else, right? And if somebody has never been married, they don't have that same sense. But people who have been married, you know, we can all say, guess what? We had to learn that not everybody squeezes the toothpaste in the same place. You know, we had to learn that. No one ever, they didn't teach you that in high school. You know, and there were things like that. You had to learn all kinds of things. Similar things about parents. How many times, parents, were you approached by some young adult who had never had kids, wasn't married or anything, but yet they knew that you were raising your kids wrong and they were going to tell you how to do it right? You know, and you're sitting there going like, okay, when your child's 2 years old, I want to come back and talk to you and I want to see if you still hold that same opinion about how you want to treat that child. But that's what happens. So common sense by itself is not universal. And hopefully we have common reasoning that we do. But we're seeing in a minute that scientists who you think would be really, really up on how to use good reasoning skills aren't always either. So what about science? So what about when you hear things that say, scientists say, what does that mean?
Well, to me, it means that science means you can repeat and prove it over and over again, which validates that.
That's what true science is about, but it's not how it's used. I'm going to get to that in a minute. You're reading my notes. Scientists say means what? More than one person who claims to be a scientist said something. That's all it means. It doesn't mean that all scientists agree, and I can guarantee you on almost any subject, you will find a card-carrying PhD scientist who disagrees and has really, sometimes really good reasons why they disagree. It's not like they're just crazy, but they say, no, I've looked at the evidence, and I think this makes more sense than that. But yet, people claim when you're looking at external evidence, and external sources, which is what we're talking about here. Well, science says. How many of you heard the term, especially in the last year, follow the science? Yeah, we've heard that, right? It's mostly talking about the COVID situation, right? But where do you go to follow the science? You got to go somewhere to some organization or some person who claims to be a scientist who says, here is the science, right? It's not something that just floats down from heaven. You got to go find it. So who's your expert? Who are you going to trust? By the way, do they all agree with each other? No. And those disagreements sometimes are very well-reasoned disagreements. It's not just, you know, somebody going off crazy somewhere, or that they're in a different country and they have a whole other culture, although that happens too. Sometimes it's like they both looked at the data and they have really different conclusions. Now, so there are four things. I got some alliteration for Stephen if he ever listens to this. There's science fact, which is kind of what you were talking about. There's science false, faulty theories and things like that. There's fake science, which are just frauds. And then there's science fiction. So science fact, my definition I put down, is something that is experimentally proven by multiple scientists in different laboratories over time. So, you know, somebody dropped a rock and timed the time it got from here to there. And they wrote it down. They said, you know what? Rocks fall this fast. Somebody else, somewhere else, read that and said, I'm going to go try that. Goes out and drops the rock, runs his clock, writes it down, compares the data. You know, that's what true science is about. It's observation, measurement, and based on those observations, is my hypothesis correct or not? That's what true science is about. The speed of light. Earth orbits the sun, although there are groups of people who deny that we do. Right? They deny the Earth is round. Limits to radio communication, for instance. Have any of you heard one of the crazy things about the internet and everything with all the information whizzing by is rumor mills are vicious now. So fast and so crazy. How many of you have heard that if you get the COVID vaccination, they're going to inject you with a chip that's going to do something? Some people say it's going to track you. Some people say it's going to influence your mind or whatever. Okay, somebody said that. Somebody started that somewhere. I can guarantee you, because I was a technologist for 40 years and a scientist, there is no way that can happen. Because I know all the technology. I have a patent. I hold a patent on an AI system that's the size of a grain of rice that you could potentially inject, right? I know this field, and I can tell you, and see, I'm asking you to believe me because of my background, you see? I can tell you there's not enough energy there to broadcast something. There's no battery. There's no way to generate the energy. The physics doesn't work. But the other thing that you think about is when you hear something like that is you ask a common sense question. The one I always hear is they're going to put something in you that lets them track you around. How many of you own one of these? Cell phone? How many of you carry it with you all the time? Guess what? Your Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, whoever you're, they track this thing. You know why? Because if you want to get a phone call, this thing is talking all the time to a tower. The tower has a physical location, so they at least know you're in that area. Every one of your phones has a GPS on it. And a lot of the apps that you are using on your phone use your GPS location, sometimes without asking you. No one needs to go through the thing about injecting a chip in you to track you around. We give them the information. So you see, that's an application of common sense. Why do something extreme and secretive and conspiratorial when in fact everybody gives the information away anyway? It doesn't make sense. Okay, I'll be done on time here. We got about 5 more minutes. Let's talk about false science. Theories and claims made based on false methods, false assumptions, flawed evidence, or by ignoring counter evidence. So a good scientist, a fair scientist, when exploring a question, because that's what scientists like to do, here's a question, let's go figure out what the answer is. You need to take all the evidence in the pile. You don't just say, I don't want to hear that evidence, I want to just use this evidence. Because what are you saying as soon as you do that? I've already made my decision regardless of what the evidence says. Now we have some real big cases of that. One of them is Darwinian macroevolution. So Charles Darwin wrote a book, Origin of Species. In this book, he put forth a hypothesis that said The reason that we have all these different animals is we were all, there was all just one common ancestor way, way back, and over lots of time, natural selection, selection pressures, and competition created all the things we have. In Origin of Species, he talks extensively about fossils. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, is the time period the book, you know, became popular, people had, there were a few fossils around. He said, he makes an assumption in Origin of Species. The fossil record will prove me right. Guess what? We've had 100 years of fossil record since then. Study of fossil record. There is no fossil record for macroevolution. There isn't one. There's no data. It's based on a false assumption. Regardless of, you know, who wants to believe it, there are millions of people who believe it and teach it. There are millions of people who use that theory as an excuse for denying the existence of God or that God created the earth, right? So this is not lightweight little, you know, disagreement over who's going to win the baseball game. It's based on a false assumption that has no data, that's never been provided, and yet people cling to it. What about, I already mentioned the Flat Earth Society. There are people who get together, and the internet allows these echo chambers to be created, where they just get together with their own little take on the world and they just reinforce each other. And they never get outside of it, so they never get challenged. And they just follow that kind of blindly. That happens a lot. What about million-year-old dating methods? So y'all have all heard about carbon, you know, carbon dating and potassium-argon dating and a few other kinds of dating. You know what the big problem with that is from a science perspective? Nobody's back there a million years to check it. Real simple. Real simple. Carbon-14, by the way, is accurate to about 6,000 years. And you know why? Because we have stuff today that we know from historical accounts was stuff that was made back then. And they ran the test on it. They calibrated it. So if you say this thing tells me that it's a million years old, how do you trust it? Because there's nothing we know is a million years old that we can calibrate it against. It's like a thermometer. Now, how do you know that a thermometer is correct? Do you know? You boil water. When the water's boiling, you put a mark where it's boiling. And you say, yep, that's 100 degrees Celsius. Right? Fahrenheit was calibrated a different way. I won't go into that, but look it up if you're interested. So if you can't calibrate it, you're basing all your assertions, that your fundamental worldview and your beliefs, on a false assumption, or at least an assumption that has not been proven. What about fake science? Who's ever heard of a Fiji mermaid? So a Fiji mermaid is a dried up body that has what looks like a human head and a fish's tail. They were actually quite popular in the 1800s. You know what it was? A monkey skull, a dried up monkey, or a shrunken head, and human heads, stitched to a dried up fish body. Literally, it's what it was. But there were people who were saying, oh yeah, we got mermaids, here's an example. Here's a body. It was faked. It was literally a lie. What about Piltdown Man? You ever hear of Piltdown Man? You ever study evolutionary history, you'll hear that. There was a guy in England who, in the early 1900s, who said, I have found the missing link. And he brings these bones to the Royal Society, and it took 41 years for them to prove him wrong, although people doubted it. Turns out he took a child's skull, fragments of a child's skull that he found, and an orangutan's jaw, and ground them so they fit. And he told everybody he'd found the missing link. It was just a lie. It was just a fraud. Do those things happen today? Absolutely. So, for instance, photographic retouching. That's been around as long as photographs, right? Fake photographs or messing with photographs. Of course, now anybody with a computer or a cell phone can take a picture and modify it to where the average person can't tell it's been modified. You can put anything you want. I could paint a very realistic looking mustache on Melinda on her Facebook, and you wouldn't know it. Except, you know, I know Melinda. She'd never wear a mustache. So computers, And now with things called deepfakes, which is using AI technology to look at these pictures, they can even make movies and videos of, say, famous people saying things those famous people would never say in their own voice. And the average person can't tell the difference. You know, so all this to say, and I gotta stop. I'm gonna continue this Wednesday night. All this to say, you need to carry around a big one of these, and any information you get off the internet, even if it's a Christian site or a Bible site, has the potential, there might be some meat on that fish, but you better watch out for the bones. And what we're going to try to do a little bit, I'm trying to do today and I'm going to try to do Wednesday night, is teach you about how to look out for the bones. Some clear signs of some bones to look out for. Okay, any comments or questions before we close? All right. Thank you all for being here.